The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this machine and do the other thing. Not because they're easy, but because they are hard.
Start by a list of 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting for 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to our Sunday Space Show program. It's Sunday afternoon, California time, by the way. And I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in. An interesting discussion awaits you today. More about that in just a minute, but a couple of very short announcements. Our program today is a full 90-minute program, so please do pay attention to the clock. And if you do want to call and talk with our guest or send in an email, please make sure you do it while we're still on air. And the newsletters are already published, and the website newsletter is already posted. And we have a full week for you coming up. So just real quickly, Tuesday night, Dr. Bruce Cordell returns, and he says there's new Maslow window information given COVID-19 and what we're doing economically and the new money we're borrowing. And so he wants to talk to us about what he sees vis-a-vis his Maslow window forecast and analysis. Hotel Mars is set with Dr. Ben Arroyo, and he wants to talk about electromagnetic pulse risk mitigation strategies underway. So that will be on Wednesday and will be available whenever John Batchelor archives that program. And on Friday, May 1st, it's hard to believe we're already into May, from Norway will be Dr. Pekka Jan Hunen, if I got that name correctly, and he's talking about his shielded dumbbell L5 settlement concept, which all of you can find and read on the National Space Society website, which is space.nss.org. And then on Sunday, I'm very, very happy to bring back Dave Mastin of Mastin Space Systems. It's been quite a while since Dave is on the Space Show. I can't wait to welcome him back, and boy, does he have a lot to talk about with lunar landers going to the moon, what Mastin has been doing for maybe the last decade and a half since he was last on the show. So we look forward to talking to Dave Mastin a week from today. And everybody, we thank you for that. And for today, our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screeners. Be patient. Let the phone ring, and we'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. You can also use email to communicate with our guest, Dr. Space, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. You can also post on our blog, which is thespaceshow.com. All the way over to the far right, you will see the upcoming show menu. Click on the first show, which is our show today. And go all the way down to the bottom, and then you'll see a place for comments and questions. As soon as you post your comment or question, I get a copy of it and can bring it up on the air. That said, remember, we are a talk show, and a talk show sort of infers that we like to talk, so we do promote and push and hope you will use our toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223. That is the highly preferred way of communicating with our guest, asking questions and offering comments on the Space Show. In addition, the Space Show's website newsletter is now published for the coming week. You can find that on the homepage on the upper right. So check it out. Make sure you scroll down and see all the programs that are set between now and, I guess, the first week of July. Remember that everything we do is archived, and you can download shows quickly off of our website or listen to them real-time off of the website. The file sizes are not too big. So either way works. And if you have any questions, don't hesitate to email me. We do have a store if you're interested in Space Show logo wear. And you get there by clicking on any of the photos of Pepper listening to the Space Show. And she will take you directly to our Cafe Press store. Remember, we are a listener-supported program, and we are a nonprofit 501c3. And we depend entirely upon listener support for bringing you great programs and guests like the one we're going to have today. And so your contributions are really important, especially during this critical time when things are so uncertain vis-a-vis health and economic issues and all of that. We're still up and running. We're maintaining our full show schedule. We really appreciate those of you who are still contributing to us. We know you have many, many challenges. The fact that you are making Space Show survival very important is really important to us as well. So PayPal is the best way to use it. There's a big PayPal button on the top of each of the Space Show website pages, and that's the fastest and easiest way to contribute. You can use checks if you want, made payable to 1ONE Giant Leap Foundation, that is our nonprofit parent. Mail the checks to Box 95, Tiburon, California, 94920. And as a nonprofit, if you're a U.S. federal taxpayer, you do get a tax deduction for your gift. The same is true if you're a California taxpayer. And OneGiantLeapFoundation.org is our parent. Check us out. If you have any nonprofit questions, don't hesitate to email me. The best way to do that is drspace@thespaceshow.com. Remember, we also have sponsors. They get the banner ad going across the homepage, which they can change whenever they want. On full-length shows like the one today, I will, during the break between first and second segment, be reading sponsor messages to you. On shorter programs than 60-minute formatted programs, to save time, I give a shout-out to each of our sponsors. But we would not be doing this program without the great support of our sponsors. We do have a couple of sponsorships still remaining for 2020 if you're interested. So please get a hold of me at drspace@thespaceshow.com, and I hope to hear from you. So for today, we have a very special guest who, by the way, came to my attention through another special guest who we have on the show a lot, actually through the Integrated Space Plan crowdfunding program last year. And so I'm very happy to introduce to everybody Dr. Iwana Kozmuda. So briefly, she's the managing partner of Gravity Free Consulting and also G-Space Incorporated, two small women-owned businesses. These two portfolio companies are a reflection of her driving passion to discover new revenue opportunities and help accelerate the time to market building on new space to discover new materials by liberating the potential design space from limiting effects of the gravitational force. By the way, I will put the websites for both of those businesses in the summary, also on the blog itself. And we're going to welcome her in just a second. But she is on the program to discuss her very unique perspective of the space-Earth confluence, in particular related to microgravity manufacturing, building on her New Space Journal paper, Exotic Optical Fibers and Glasses, Innovative Material Processing Opportunities in Earth's Orbit, plus a follow-up by the recent SPIE 2020 paper, Breaking the Silica Ceiling, Zeebland-based Opportunity for Photonic Applications. I will put the URL references for both of these articles on the blog as soon as today's show ends. Her full bio is on the website, and there is much more to read about our guest, but I want to talk with her. Dr. Kozmuda, welcome to the Space Show. How are you today?
Hello, David. Thank you so much for such a kind introduction, and it's a great pleasure and honor to be on this show. I'm doing well, and I'm really grateful for the sunny California weather. I hope we can spread some of that sunshine through the show as well to our listeners.
Yeah, it is beautiful. I hear they're storming Sausalito as if it's a beautiful July 4th day. So for those of you who don't know, Sausalito is just across the Golden Gate Bridge and right on the bay. And it's a beautiful town with a lot of tourist appeal. And apparently there's no shelter in place for Sausalito today. So I've seen pictures, and it does remind me of a really beautiful July 4th parade and all. We're happy to have you on board the program. And I guess we should start out, and you have many years at NASA, and then you left NASA, and now you've formed these two businesses. Tell us a little bit about this transition, why you wanted to go from NASA to an entrepreneur with these two primarily women-focused businesses, and what they're all about, and what you're doing now, and do you miss NASA?
Okay, that's a bunch of questions. I may not remember them all, but I know you're there, and if I miss one, we can come back at it. So, very interesting. I actually never ever dreamt of, or never aimed at, working in the space program. So, as an immigrant to this country, I'm originally from Romania. I ended up by pure chance working for NASA, and after 16 years of working in the space program, I started out as a scientist in the Center for Nanotechnology, and then I realized I'm as a woman, I'm immersed in this sea of aerospace engineering. So I wanted to understand how do we translate science to engineering, and then fast forward to 2012. I got involved with the Emerging Space Office, led at that time by Dr. Alexander MacDonald, NASA's chief economist, into taking a fresh look at ISS commercialization, in particular microgravity commercialization, what worked, what didn't, what are the things that we should be doing, and how should we be doing things differently, what were the barriers and the opportunities. So I discovered my passion about commercialization, and in particular about these what I call space-Earth confluence. And the reason I call it this way is because up to maybe 2010, if you follow the history of what was going on in space, and how space exploration started, it was more out of military purposes. And only through the emergence and the strengthening of this new space move do we see now a peaceful exploration of space, and more of a exploration of space for public benefit and economic growth. So that was a trend that actually was significant, and is still a significant portion of NASA, but it wasn't that much amplified. So I guess in that period between 2012 and 2018, I've done a lot of studies on how can we do better in not only translating the scientific benefits of what we've discovered in microgravity, but also the benefits of all the investments in space technology, and how can we align those with terrestrial global needs, given the requirements that were taken into account when we developed these space technologies. And then also, how do we really create meaningful and prosperous businesses around space, because it really isn't an easy endeavor. So that is really the context of while I was at NASA, I was mostly talking about these things and also trying to help and support the entrepreneurial move. But I realized that I won't actually know what an entrepreneur goes through unless I try to do it myself. So that was one motivation. And the other motivation for it was, given where I am in my life, I'm like, well, if I don't do it now, which was 2018, I'm going to be way too old to even experience it later. So there's a combination of personal and professional reasons for trying to do this. And I can admit that it's really not easy. So, and like you very nicely read from my bio, it is a reflection. The two businesses that I currently lead and work on are a reflection of my two passions. One is, how can I help others understand the difficulties of a space business, and how do you properly de-risk a space business? And then the other one is more my technology roots and my deep tech roots on how can we create new materials for terrestrial commercial markets, but by leveraging on the gravitational force and turning that gravitational force as a design parameter.
Okay, so there's a lot of things to unpack, but I'm going to ask you a question, and if you don't want to answer it, that's fine. But as an entrepreneur and as one who's done entrepreneurial things all my life, including really late in my life, I never considered I was like too late, or if I didn't do it now, it would be too late. So you said you were looking at your life and you realized if you didn't do it now, it would be too late. So I'm not asking you about age or anything like that, but but what is your criteria for it's too late to do it? Because I'm, you know, I started the space show 20 years ago, and I did my doctoral dissertation, you know, when I was pretty late in life too. And I never thought in terms of it's too late. And now I'm looking at writing up the book on the space shows 20 years, and I'll be 74 in June. And I've not thought in terms of too late. So how do you judge too late? And I'm asking you because, number one, it might be a real eye-opener and shock some reality and truth into me. And number two, I think it's a really interesting thing that a lot of people maybe question if they want to start something, leave their business, start something afresh but on their own, start a new venture, and maybe they're retired already. Is it too late? How did you decide that?
It's a really good question. And again, it's more of a, that was what I felt. It doesn't mean that what I felt necessarily would resonate with it. But I'll give you some, you know, some metrics or some considerations, right?
Okay.
And building a successful business takes a lot of time and a lot of energy. And usually we have that time and the energy when we're young, and we also don't have commitment, right? I also have a family. I have two kids plus a dog. So it's really, I have to use extreme discipline in order to be able to balance all the responsibilities that I have, especially as a woman in a business, and to make sure that also, you know, my business thrives, right?
Right.
So from that perspective, I definitely don't see myself having more energies when I'm going to be in my 50s. I'm in my 40s, right? I've learned that, you know, when I was in my 20s, I thought I will have infinite energy for my entire life. Well, I'm in my 40s, and I've learned I won't have infinite energy for my entire life, and I will have less. So I became more aware of the fact that, you know, how do you keep a good balance in your life between following your passion and trying to create value, right, in your business, while at the same time not letting that be the only thing that defines you, not letting that devour you, right? And
right.
That was really a challenge for me personally. On the other end, I've read, and you know, I've had discussions with some friends it's very interesting because, of course, depending on what age you are, you read different things. So what I read was that being an entrepreneur, and actually a successful entrepreneur, the best time of, you know, for that is when you're in your 40s. But my friend, he's in his 60s, and he said, oh, I read the same thing, and they're saying that being an entrepreneur is the best thing to be when you're in your 60s. So I guess I don't know where the truth lies. I guess in terms of the maturity and experience, There is a truth to that, because when you're in your 40s, you have more experience. You've tried certain things, and especially in my case, right, I got to experiment with a lot of ideas and a lot of these risks and so on while I was at NASA. So I could bring that practice and experience into my business, and that, I believe, made the path to defining the niche that's very important for a successful entrepreneurial endeavor much shorter, right? So from that perspective, that experience is balanced when you're in your 40s versus when you're in your 20s and you're just going based on more of enthusiasm, energy, and passion. But that's not balanced with the realities of how do you really implement that, how difficult really it is to make a business successful. And then in the 60s, I think you really leverage more on the fact that usually, you know, all these other responsibilities that we have in our life tend to kind of go in the background, right? I mean, if you have kids and so on, then they're on their own. You do have, again, more of a free time. You also have that additional experience. I mean, that's definitely between the 40s and the 60s. You gain additional experience. But then I think it's really how do you balance, you know, the energy with the experience. I hope that makes sense.
So it does. So I, like you, used to think I would have infinite energy. So if you think the 60s are something, wait till you hit the 70s. So, but I believe there's a lot of truth, because I don't want to discourage any of the older folks from starting a business or doing something. And I joke on the air about geezers and stuff like that. But the other balancing factor is, and everybody says this, and there's famous quotes about it, and I can't even think of who some of the famous people are, but wisdom is wasted on the older. And, you know, if you were 40 and had the wisdom of someone in the 70s or the 80s, but we're not yet senile, you know, you'd be way, way, way ahead of the game. So in many ways, you can compensate for lack of energy or less energy with a lot of wisdom and doing things in smarter ways.
Now, and you're bringing here a really, really good point, because in my opinion, actually the best combination in an entrepreneurial business. So what another thing that defines a successful, you know, entrepreneurial business is the team that you build.
Right.
Uh-huh. So if you're able in that team to bring in and leverage, you know, the enthusiasm of the young, and to put in the mentorship that you are, and then to leverage on the generations that ahead of you, their extra wisdom that they bring in, I think then that's a really key element, key ingredient to the success.
No, I agree. And for people who are usually starting out and they're one or two people, if you have a brain trust that maybe is older people with more experience and you can lean on their wisdom, it can make a big difference for you as you're younger. But anyway, I was curious as to your metrics on, you know, your comment where you had to do it sort of now or never. And that would have probably been the same of if you were starting a terrestrial business that didn't have anything to do with space. But thank you for explaining that.
I think it was also the space. So, of course, I didn't go out there and try to build a business that had no relationship to space.
Okay? No, right.
So,
you did it with the space.
So
business,
that aspect of space came into play, indeed, because I was really trying to get to help a lot of the businesses, specifically in this killer app that I've identified, like you said, you know, to the paper I've published and to the internal report we submitted to NASA. I've identified this VBLAN manufacturing as one of the killer apps. The other one that I worked on was the vascular tissue challenge, and there's many other more efforts that I work on. But again, my passion was more on the material science, because it also aligns very much with my background. And despite of the fact that I was trying, you know, from the inside to drive, you know, and to drive where this, how do we turn this killer app into an actual success story? I really felt, I mean, we first talked about it in 2012, 2013. Here we are in 2020, and we still haven't done it, right? So I realized that, you know, the pace at which I wanted to see things happening and to see things done just didn't happen internally, right?
Uh-huh.
For a variety of reasons, some of them for which I missed and some of them I don't, talking about, you know, how much I miss NASA, right?
Right.
And I felt that, you know, if I really, and actually I had a lot of people telling me, hey, Ioana, actually you should step out and do this because you're the best person to do this. And I didn't think of it that way. I didn't think of myself that way, but I thought, hey, maybe that is a good point. So it was the timing of it as well.
You mentioned these two businesses, so why don't you sort of briefly tell us what each one does, and are they very different from each other? Do they support and spill over on one another? Oh, that's great. I lost her.
I'm back.
Listeners, we're back with our guest, and sorry about that. For archive listeners, I will remove all of the dead air and the problems, so you may not know what we're talking about, but live listeners will know what we're talking about. So welcome back from the dead, and I'm glad you're back with us. you were about to tell us the similarities and differences between your two companies.
Okay, so nothing of that got recorded. I really got
no, nothing. We just as you started,
the
line went dead.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Apologies for that. I have no idea what's happening these days with a basic, simple service such as a phone call. You know, being able to do a phone call. But so I was saying that when I left NASA, my first thought was that I could take all that experience and bring it out to the world and share it, whether it is a startup trying to de-risk their business model or whether it is a Fortune 500 company that was not a traditional space player, but they were interested or curious enough because of their commitment to internal innovation to understand what's going on in space and what are potential opportunities for that company to become maybe a player in a new space. And then the third thing was the fact that with Gravity Free, the LRC, I was also able to go globally much more easier. Because in the end, I believe that the new space move is a global move, and we shouldn't be taking there and propagating, you know, swim lanes and conflicts. We should be really leveraging on new space, and when we go to space, united in a humanity united spirit. So that is the commitment behind Gravity Free, and the reason I actually thought my experience would be valuable is because of that unique view that I built within NASA, where it is for the first time, I believe, and I stand correctly if I'm wrong, but it was for the first time that I actually took a deep look into terrestrial industry's roadmaps and try to understand where these terrestrial industries were going because of self-defined interest or self-stated interest, and what were the needs, and how could those needs then be potentially met with what we've been developing in space and the investments. How could we leverage that by connecting, by creating industry specific infusion point for both microgravity and space technology discoveries. So that's, you know, that I actually, when I was at NASA, I created this concept of microgravity verticals exactly to show in a compressed manner the value for terrestrial industries what we've been doing in space. And the principle before that, before I took a look into these things, was more like, oh, we've done these very cool things in space, and, you know,
someone will come and do something about it versus us going out and proactively communicating that value. So that's the gravity free consulting. And I'll take a break here if there's any comments or questions, and then I can talk about the other business.
So you look for businesses that are trying to do things along the lines of what you believe your experience can help them accomplish, and then you consult with them or you help them manage projects or something of that nature?
Yeah, I help them manage projects. So it depends. Again, if it's a startup, I'll help them understand here's the real risk portfolio of your business, and here are ways to de-risk it. Here are ways to go after public funding so that you're not really having to give equity too early and too much. And then on the bigger business side, there's more companies who already have a know-how. So for example, it could be a telecom company, a large multinational telecom company that would be interested in how can we now understand better the satellite constellations that are forming out there, what are the offerings, and what are the real offerings of these satellite constellations, and how can they, for example, maybe compete with the terrestrial development in 5G technology. So that's another example. And then also working with governments of different countries when they're trying to shape their policy in new space, what they want to do, how they should do it, and so on. So there's this kind of three types of customers that I've been primarily working with.
Okay. And and then the other company that you work with, does it overlap with that? Is it completely different?
So it's a completely different one, but it was incubated in Gravity Free. So I also consider Gravity Free as an incubation company. And then G-Space is at this point, it's an independent company. It's a spin-off of Gravity Free, but it's independent. And it's very interesting. So I believe it's extremely important to emphasize that G-Space is a B corporation. And I really was looking, so I'm going to talk a little bit about the legal framework and how that legal framework could support or not what we're trying to do in new space, right? And
okay,
going back to my belief that new space should really bring out the best value creation process that humanity can put out there, I don't think a C corporation is the right framework. So the B corporation is more of a step forward. So you got the definition. You look at the definition of new space, right? And it says that it's space for social economic benefit. So that should be reflected in the structure, the legal structure, the legal DNA of an entity that that's created and operates in the new space economy. So B corporation, by definition, has that social economic benefit that needs to prove, and it can balance, that concept of making money at all costs. I think it also keeps the potential investors at their better angels. And so, again, G-Space, to my knowledge, again, I stand corrected, I believe it's the only new space company that is a B corporation. And what we do in that is we design, it's an AI platform, it's a terrestrial platform at this point. And what we do is we have a unique set of experiments and software that we're combining in order to expand the envelope of materials that can be discovered by turning gravity into a variable. So when you remove gravity, you can actually look into the phase diagrams of materials and explore areas that are not stable under gravitational force. So if everybody else is looking into producing materials or new materials. Nobody is really looking on a commercial basis with an accelerated commercialization timeline in this area that's outside of the traditional phase diagram.
So you divide equal time between the two, more time to one or the other?
Yeah, it kind of, you know, it depends. It, in average, is about 50-50. Yeah, that's what I would say, yeah, at this point. Yeah. And, you know, there's always, you know, sometimes you need to prioritize one and, you know, leave the other one more in the background. And, I mean, everybody working in management consulting knows that the flow is not constant, right, the flow of customers. So, of course, then, you know, there are periods when you become very busy on one side and, you know, less involved on the other side and vice versa.
So, Todd has your first email question of the day. He's in San Diego.
Okay.
And he says, how vulnerable are either of these two businesses to government regulation and policy? And I'm not just thinking of the United States, since you've talked numerous times today about being globally minded.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm assuming global regulatory regimes and things of that nature might impact you too. How vulnerable are these businesses to those issues?
So I'll talk about the LLC. I think the LLC actually neither of them are very vulnerable at this point. There's a minimum vulnerability. I think the vulnerability comes more when you talk about, you know, a launch system or building a hypersonic vehicle and stuff like that. I mean, as long as you stay within the bounds of EAR and ITAR, then, you know, it's fine. Actually, you know, the businesses like this are encouraged to work internationally and so on, as long as, again, you respect the secrets and especially ITAR aspects of any technology, which neither of my businesses carry at this point.
Government policy doesn't get in the way of trying to build a business or compete in the new space economy?
So far, personally, I haven't seen that. Now, there are certain limitations, and I know of other businesses that, I mean, space law is very important because, again, it's that white space in which we need to build policies that connect the goodwill of the different countries of what they want to build in space. And that is a very, very difficult problem. It's a very difficult challenge, right? So I think, you know, maybe one of the things that that I could comment on is, let's say you want to work with a company in Taiwan or a company in Singapore or a company in Belarus. The aspect of this business that become touchy, at least from my experience, is maybe some IP sharing. Who owns the IP? And of course, if you get government funding on the U.S. side, they really want to make sure that, you know, that entity is U.S. held, and that is of course the case in our company. But it may hamper your ability. So let's say you come to appreciate the IP value of a company in a different country, and it is, you know, it's kind of an equal contribution, then it opens up other kind of questions. But, you know, I think there's also solutions, right? You can build joint ventures, and here's very important to have very good legal advice. We work with WilmerHale, and we've gotten extremely, extremely good guidance from them, and they actually have a very, very good program for startups in general. So I think there's ways around it, but it doesn't mean that all these landscape has been well thought, well defined. I think there's a lot of people working in defining all this, the space law aspect of it. So I would let those people comment more on this.
Can you sort of give us an idea of of some real life projects or programs that you've undertaken, say with Gravity Free, starting there? Some examples, some maybe real life cases.
One example that I know I can talk freely about, that's because the information is public, is Business Finland. So Business Finland is an organization working in the Finnish government, and one of the areas that they're very interested in building, and they're actually actively building, is the new space economy. So I worked with them through a study that they funded. So that was a public offering to which I responded, and I helped create a material, a package that shows what are U.S. market entry opportunities specifically tuned for the Finnish offerings. And so there was a part of that study that was confidential, but if you go and look on the Business Finland New Space website, you will see both the public release of that package, as well as the webinar that that we held. Again, that was also a public public release. So that's an example. And we also did a couple of days in which we trained certain startups that the Business Finland brought forward. So we looked over their pitch deck, and we really provided them suggestions for improvements on, how can they shape their offering, what would be, again, business opportunities that they could tackle in the U.S. And then from there, they have to find their own path, and we do help on an as-needed basis and whatever is possible.
You have another question. George is in Denver, Colorado, and he says, does our program to possibly return to the moon, hopefully we do, at least that's my idea, is that helpful with trying to develop more of a new space approach to space and the economy, or does the moon or going to Mars not enter into anything?
So, you see, one of the areas that I worked on while I was at NASA, or at least I put a lot of thinking into, was, if you look back at the history of investments in space technology, and I'm really not talking here that much about the Science Mission Directorate, but more about the Human Mission Directorate in NASA, there is a tendency for those investments to flip based on, which party is leading the country, right? So you could see a 4-year or an 8-year cycle to those investments, and it tends to be going to the moon or going to Mars. And unfortunately, when you build a system architecture, you go into the final key performance parameters of that architecture, and then you say, okay, we need to align those technologies. And I think it leads to unsustainable space exploration. If you would take all those investments and think of it of expanding the industrial base into LEO and then in the cislunar space, building the infrastructure that's absolutely needed before you reach a destination or another. So build this infrastructure agnostic, destination agnostic infrastructure, then I think we have a much better path for a sustainable space exploration in the future. So what I'm talking about is the gas stations in space, the communication centers in space, right? And so building first that infrastructure in LEO and expanding the terrestrial industrial base into LEO and embed LEO in our daily lives is an absolutely necessary space and a step. And then, expand into that and just think of all the space between here and the moon and Mars and all those nodes that can be mapped. And I think there is an MIT study, if I remember it correctly. I hope I don't misquote it. But David, if you want to capture that in the notes after the call, I'm happy to point you to that study that really looked at machine learning and AI to see what would be good points in the cislunar space of placing infrastructure, and how would a space infrastructure look like that would, again, provide that network of support for growth into then settlement on the moon and Mars.
I would reference that paper in the summary, so I can send you a reminder, or if you remember, that would be
sure.
Excellent. So there's a lot of talk about developing cislunar and doing some of the infrastructure things that you want. There have even been appeals to include space infrastructure like that in any kind of infrastructure bills that Congress ultimately puts forth. I don't know if that will happen or not, but I think it would be very beneficial if it did happen. I don't really see how you get to develop much of space if we don't start developing some needed cislunar type of infrastructure. So I'm personally hoping that that does happen.
And I mean another aspect of this infrastructure, right, is let's talk a little bit about space manufacturing, right, where you now develop goods and manufacture goods in space, right, because it's very different. So right now, the whole new space move, the part of the economy in new space that really has created a market is centered around data as a commodity. And data can be sent from space without having the need for a physical capability to carry back a physical product, right? But as we move into space manufacturing, and if we really want to have a commitment to a successful space manufacturing effort, we really need to create that infrastructure. And returning samples from orbit or from space, it's actually a very difficult area. In particular, because it relies on what I talked before, hypersonic technology, and I think that is a very sensitive matter. So I cannot emphasize enough that in order to bring back samples from space and make sure that a space manufacturing effort is truly successful and start growing, there needs to be a solution there. And, it connects with the fact that we want to have U.S. supremacy in space, or different countries want to have supremacy in space. You know? And I think it's not having a supremacy in space. It's not one or the other. We can go as a united humanity, and then make sure that everything that's unique to a country is still respected and preserved, and not turn this into a race necessarily, but an effort, a coordinated effort for a common good that really helps everybody grow. And if you think of the Space Earth Conference, right, terrestrially, there's been a lot of study that show that a sustainable future that leaves behind a respectful amount of resources for the next generation is at odds with economic growth. That only happens if you think of Earth as a closed system. While Earth is an open system, and you can tap into resources outside of the surface of the Earth. So the new space move really comes in as a great solution where you can balance that sustainable future with an economic growth and with distribution of wealth across the world. And distribution of wealth across the world also comes with more peace and more of a prosperous humanity. I hope that makes sense.
It does. Are we on that path right now, in your opinion?
I don't think I'm the best person to talk about this. From my observations, and again, I've read a couple of studies that were done globally. I definitely don't think we're on a path to a sustainable future. It doesn't sound that the data points that we're on a path for economic growth either. And we're also, unfortunately, not on a path for growing democracy. Over the past decade, there's a not-for-profit organization, global organization, that put out a study that showed that actually democracy is on a decline over the past decade. So if you add these three things up, I would say we're not really engaged on a path for a prosperous future for everybody.
Very interesting. I have another email that let me read to you. So this is from Luis in Venezuela, and he says, somehow related to the previous question on NASA's moon push, how promising do you see NASA's approach to migrating LEO to commercial initiatives, and how does that help your work?
Could you read that again?
Okay.
Make sure I understand it exactly.
Somehow related to the previous question on NASA's moon push, how promising do you see NASA's approach to migrating LEO to commercial initiatives, and how does that help your work?
Yeah. So this commercial, I think, public-private partnerships are extremely important and are key to support any future developments towards that what do I call integrated space infrastructure, right? So to reference back to how I got introduced to this show, I don't see, and again, maybe it's on me. I haven't studied enough. I've been outside of NASA for the past 2 years, so I'm less intimately connected with exactly what is going on. But I really haven't seen anything in the policy that talks about this systematic development. So the moon is on the path to Mars, but there is, again, no investments that I have seen that are dedicated to growing the infrastructure, the space infrastructure beyond LEO. And why is that important is, you know, yes, so public-private partnerships, they're definitely strong because they combine the ability of the government to fund and de-risk very early companies and, you know, that entrepreneurial drive on the startup side. So that's I think that's great. But it's still extremely difficult to help startups be successful in creating something on the moon. It's very, very difficult, right? I mean, we've seen, you know, all these lunar lander efforts where they failed, and they failed for a variety of reasons that I don't want to go into right now. But on one hand, they're fantastic examples of determination and passion and drive, but I don't think those are leveraged enough and leveraged smartly and support it with the proper government investment. And again, what's missing here is that systematic roadmap of how are we going to take all this money and how are we going to build something that creates value long term and populate that space between the cislunar space with the infrastructure that then helps public-private partnerships be even more effective and successful.
Okay. Louise, if that's fine, great. And if you want more, please send us another email. In the meantime, you have a caller on hold.
Sure.
Good afternoon, caller. Who are you? Where are you? Thank you for calling.
Hello. Hi, this is John in Fremont, California.
Hi, John. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you. Interesting show. So, hi, Ilana.
Hi, John.
My question refers to microgravity manufacturing in low Earth orbit. Did I hear you say previously that that's going to depend on technologies to get the products back to Earth, and so hypersonic vehicles have to be developed first?
It's not the first versus the other, right? But it is an absolute, you know, an absolute necessary way. I mean, think, okay, so let's think of it. let's say you want to manufacture a material in Earth orbit that, so let's talk about, you know, like the, what Germans refer to as the Gedanken experiment, right? You want to manufacture something in orbit and you want to scale that up, right? And you want to scale manufacturing, and at the same time, you want to have quarterly revenues because you secure customers and your customers.
Ah, crap. John, are you there?
Yeah.
I don't know what's wrong with her. Everybody, hold on. Let me see if I can get her back on.
Should John repeat the question, or do you remember?
No, I remember the question. Is
okay.
That you didn't hear anything of my answer. I just wanted
no,
to
No.
Okay.
No,
okay.
Should repeat your answer starting from the beginning again.
Sure. So what I was saying is, let's discuss here a little bit. So I think your answer would be much more easier to imagine if we're talking about what German call a Gedanken experiment, right? And so what does that mean is, let's say we identify a material of high value that we want to manufacture in space, right? But at the same time, we're a business where the only thing that we want to do is make that material, sell that material, right? And we want to make quarterly revenue, which means we want to make sure that we have the infrastructure, the transportation infrastructure up and down that enables us to take what we need to take up there, do what we need to do up there, and then bring it down so that we can meet that quarterly revenue. Right now, that thing is not there. There's no company right now that can ensure you that you can have that on a reliable, in a reliable way, right? So then that goes into, well, what are other options? Well, you can buy a garden lab, a huge, you know, lab, and then populate that and have it, you know, once a year, and then bring it, have it fly up, stay there for a year, bring it down once a year. But it's a huge investment, right, to buy a dragon lab. So what's the intermediate? The intermediate would be maybe a small sample return, and I've studied that during my hypersonic years. I studied this sample return like architecture that could be very feasible. But of course, you know, there's a lot, and it has been done before. It's just it has been done again with government investments, which are again higher than what you would want to have as a commercially operating company. So there's a lot of issues there, but in my opinion, right now, it has to do with the ability of bringing back the samples in order to meet a quarterly revenue schedule. And so bringing back those samples means you need to have some thermal protection system on your pre-flight that comes back or on that sample return capability, or you need to have a very smartly designed LOD return capability, right, that's miniaturized enough to bring you the samples back. So anyhow, that segment, the return segment of if you think of a life cycle, right, of I do something terrestrially, then I fly something, I land something in space, I do something in space, and I want to return. That segment of the return is really lagged behind. Does that answer your question, John?
It does. So that means that we're not there yet. So you know, I think there's in the future at this point.
It's not commercially streamlined. Yeah, it's not commercially streamlined, which is why, you know, deep space is not even, you know, I mean, what we do at deep space, everything is terrestrial at this point. So that's how we circumvented, you know, that cycle, because I don't think that cycle really is matured enough right now to ensure, you know, a streamlined manufacturing process in space.
So, are there any companies that you're aware of that are working on, you know, retrieval of small payloads from low Earth
orbit? Yeah, there's Intuitive Machines, for what I know. To be honest, I haven't really looked, in the past 2-3 months on what are the developments there, but it's kind of a chicken and egg, right? Because people are saying, well, we develop that capability when we show which material is the one that really has that high-value market traction. and the people who are doing the, well, we have the material, but we don't have the capability. So it's a chicken and egg kind of thing here, at least from my understanding.
Okay, well, thank you all. Let someone else call in.
Thank you, John.
Thanks, John.
Listeners, that line is available if you would like to use it, and it is 1-866-687-7223. We're a little beyond, we're way beyond the halfway point, but let me pause us here for a couple of minutes, and I'll do my my sponsor messages. So I want to thank our sponsors for our great sponsorship help that they have given us. You can hold on the phone. This will be about 2 minutes, and then we'll come right back with part two of the program, okay? Listeners, let's take a brief pause, and we'll do our sponsor messages right now. So we definitely want to thank our great sponsors for making these space show programs possible. Northrop Grumman is a sponsor. They're a leading global security company providing innovative systems, products, and solutions to government and commercial customers worldwide, offering an extraordinary portfolio of capabilities and technologies for applications from undersea to outer space, including cyberspace. The Space Foundation sponsors us. They have the really great Space Symposium. This year was to have been the 36th symposium. They had to cancel it because of the COVID-19 virus. Every year it's held around early April. And it is at the Broadmoor Hotel, Colorado Springs. Check their website to see if it can be rescheduled this year or how they're going to work it out for next year. SpaceSymposium.org. It's an incredible event, great networking, an incredible display and products tent, that actually several tents. It's a once-in-a-lifetime experience. If you've never been, you definitely want to go to one. Astrox Corporation sponsors us. They have been involved in hypersonic space plane and reusable rocket designs for the Air Force, DARPA, and NASA for over 3 decades. Their proprietary codes, HiSide and SpaceSide, create and analyze such designs. Please visit astrox.com for more information. And we thank Dr. A.J. Kothari for his sponsorship. AIAA sponsors us, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. It is the world's largest aerospace professional society, and we really appreciate their sponsorship. They have great events and regional events as well, breakfast, lunch, dinner meetings. You don't have to be an engineer to be a member. Their 5 big events have incredible networking. And they have a library of peer-reviewed papers going back decades, which you can access, AIAA.org. MoonWords sponsors us. What if a group of nations was determined to build a town on the moon, and they based their decisions only on technical and economic merit? MoonWords is building a digital vision of that town where you will be able to learn, play, build, and go to events. Visit MoonWords.com to download an early draft demo of the town and to fund its development by subscribing. Help us help the world see a bigger future where we can leave our past behind us. We are fortunate that Celestis sponsors us. They are still the iconic global memorial spaceflight provider service company. They have flights out of the Cape that are orbital. And then they do suborbital out of New Mexico at Spaceport America. They have an orbital mission coming up. Was to be fourth quarter this year. We'll see if they can get that launched on time. And then they have their second lunar mission coming up, fourth quarter of 2021. You can add some of your DNA with your loved one's ashes or DNA and make the symbolic trip to space with your loved one. For all of the information, contact Celestis, CELESTIS.com. The National Space Society sponsors us. They do ISDC every year, but it got canceled this year because of COVID-19. It's being combined with ISDC in Los Angeles for 2021. But the National Space Society is involved with lots of other projects, including space settlement. Check out their website for all of their information. And you can do that at space,
www.nss.org. And then the Integrated Space Plan sponsors us. This is the highly detailed development chart showing the path to becoming a spacefaring race. You can see how technologies and destinations build upon one another. Explore hundreds of individual elements in more detail at thespaceplan.com. And you can get your own copy of it. It's a full-color, full-length poster. Comes in two sizes. It's useful. It's inspiring. It's a good instructional tool. You can frame it, hang it on the wall. I very strongly recommend it. I have it hanging on the door to my studio. Visit thespaceplan.com. And we certainly appreciate our sponsors. As I said, we would not be doing this program without them. We do have a couple of sponsorships available still for 2020. And if you would like to become a sponsor, contact me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Remember, your sponsor messages, they really live on forever, because if someone hears an archive show 5 years from today, they're going to hear your sponsor message. So it's an incredible value, and if there's anything close to perpetuity, it is Space Show archive programs. Remember, all of our programs are still available from the very, very first one in early 2001. Thank you. And we're going to go to the second segment of the program. John, I have the recording of her answer to you, even though I forgot to turn that on. So I will cut and splice that in so you will have that. And we will go and start the second segment. Man, this was my fault. I forgot to hit the button after I got you back on the phone. So nothing will be lost to anybody. And we have a caller waiting. So, Iwana, are you okay with that?
I'm here. Yeah, I'm here. Sure, sure. We need to hang on to whatever technical difficulties you have. No worries.
So, John, thank you for your email. And hi, caller. We're in part two. Do you have a question or call for us? And who are you and where are you, please?
Hi, David. Hi, Dr. Kuzmuda. My name is Jeff. I'm calling from North Carolina.
Okay.
And the first time to call your show, David.
Okay.
But I've listened to it several times. I have a couple of questions for the doctor. Can we make carbon nanotubes in microgravity that are superior to the carbon nanotubes on Earth? Has anybody done an experiment on the ISS or otherwise using maybe single crystal carbon nanotubes or single wall carbon nanotubes? And two, what about boron nitride nanotubes? Has anybody tried to build those in microgravity? I'm thinking that without the gravity, you might be able to build big, longer fibers or more pure fibers in space than you can on the ground. And I had one more question, but I'll let her answer those two first.
Sure. So the breadth of experiments in microgravity is very impressive, both on the material science and life science side. As of 2016-17, when I last reviewed that breadth of investigations on the International Space Station, I'm not aware of anybody building or growing a carbon nanotube or a boron nitride nanotube in microgravity. And we actually, so when I worked on this ISS commercialization effort out of the Emerging Space Office, I worked at the space portal here at NASA Ames with Dr. Daniel Rasky. And about nine students, each of them looking into a different area. One of them actually looked into the growth of carbon nanotubes. And in particular, what we wanted to use is, interesting, the environmental control life support system on the International Space Station creates carbon. So you need a source of carbon, right, in order to grow these carbon nanotubes. So we looked a little bit into that and that what would be the challenges of doing so. But I think there's a lot of information and know-how required before you even try to go into space, and that's what G-Space does. So we look into all these interesting problems, and we have a suite of algorithms that that we can combine with some experiments that we can do terrestrially to even address, okay, what is the feasibility, and if you really want to go and do these things, what are the optimized parameters of the space that you should consider when you want to manufacture these things in space? Does that make sense?
Yes, sure. It certainly does. Add two more questions, and then I'll let somebody else get on the line. What about making graphene on orbit? Is there any advantage to doing that? And two, whatever happened to the acoustic levitator that was put on a space station? I think it was called the Space Drums. I don't know if it's still there or if they still use it, or I don't know if you have any information about that. But it seems to me acoustic levitation would be something you want to look at containerless processing and a follow-on to, say, electromagnetic levitators and electrostatic levitators. So graphene, any question about that, and acoustic levitation? Thank you.
Yeah, so I think, again, I would take the answer for, you know, carbon nanotubes and boron nitride tubes and graphene. I would put it in the same category. That, you know, you can contact me and we can discuss this offline a little bit in more detail.
Okay.
I would want to comment a little bit on the levitator. So there's many ways of levitating something. Acoustic is one of them, and it depends what you want to do for what purpose. The problem with acoustic levitators is if you're interested in doing high-temperature processing, you can't do it with an acoustic levitator. So there's pros and cons of different methodologies. You can do electrostatic levitation, you can do electromagnetic, you can do acoustic, you can do optical levitation, etc., etc., right? And there's pros and cons for each of these methodologies, but it really depends. If you really want, so you see, if you want to use this method for space manufacturing, then you really need to make sure that you get the right science data. And in order to get the right science data, you need to ask yourself, what is it that you want to extract out of that levitation technique? So it's a more complicated answer, but just the simple one is acoustic levitation doesn't work, for example, if you really want to go explore phase diagrams of materials or really do high-temperature processing, etc.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. All right, thank you. Thank you, David. I'll get off the phone and let someone else call in.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
And listeners, the line is available. And again, sorry, everybody, for my glitch, but archive listeners will not miss anything or probably even know that there was a glitch. The phone line is available if somebody else would like to call, 1-866-687-7223. And as I said, that line is available right now. Our friend in Venezuela has a quick follow-up for you. He just sent in an email, Luis, so let me read you his note. So Luis says, thanks a lot for your answer. I agree moon focus public-private partnerships will be very challenging. That's what I meant, that freeing up NASA LEO budgets to some degree by migrating it to commercials might help, though I read that it has its own challenges and has been met by some pushback from Congress, among others. Do you have any insight into this?
Well, I can have some thoughts, and again, I would really need to sit down and look at the data for both, you know, budget and information and, you know, how do you accomplish certain things. It's all about how do you put in place a schedule, and how do you spread out the investments in order to accomplish certain milestones? But at the same time, all these schedules should last across different administrations, right? Because that's very important. So LEO commercialization right now, you still need the investment because that segment is not fully solidified. You cannot move to the next step and say, well, I, you know, let me redirect all the resources from LEO commercialization into Moon commercial public-private partnership, Moon public-private partnership, because that would leave LEO without the support, and without the LEO being consolidated, you would then fail in the next systematic step. I mean, at least that's my my first response to your comment. So it really has to do with the short-term versus the long-term thinking, and how do you want to accomplish certain things, and how do you set in place a schedule that is administration agnostic but really is focused on creating long-time value with the outcome of sustainable and exploration, right? Not put and slack wing, but, you know, long-term access to space that's ensured.
You're not asking for much there, are you?
Well, everything starts from somewhere, right?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Luis, I hope that is fine. And if you have more, please continue to send in your emails. And listeners' emails go to Dr. Space, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And, of course, you can call us. Our toll-free number is 866-687-7223. How does what's happening economically around the world vis-a-vis the virus, is this going to be a sort of a temporary glitch and delay, or are we looking at long-term systematic changes?
It's hard to tell. I think it will have an impact. It already has an impact. But I think we'll see more of it in the next, you know, 6 months to a year, and we'll learn more of it. We already see an impact on the new space economy, right, with some companies filing for bankruptcies. And not necessarily that this is the trigger, but this is, you know, that drop that fills the glass. And it tips the balance into, you know, an unfortunate outcome for, you know, for certain companies. I mean, all the businesses are struggling. That's very clear. But I think there is also a positive outcome for this pandemic. And I hope I can capture that right. So I think there's a lot of stuff that we humans do, and we're constantly doing something. And that constantly doing something doesn't necessarily lead to value creation. We have forgotten that value creation is not directly tied to working 24/7, but it ties to how do you work in a disciplined and effective way to minimize waste. So globally, I think we pretty much agree that we, humanity, we generate a lot of waste in many different areas, whether it's business practices to products and so on. And I think having this pandemic forced us to stop a little bit and ponder upon ourselves that's at least my hope, will lead to maybe a little bit of a reassessment. Should we really go back to the way we used to live and run our daily lives, whether it is an individual, a local community, a government, a company, etc. What is it that we really want to accomplish, and how can we truly be committed to create value and minimize waste? So I think that becomes more of a philosophy. And if I may add here, one thing, you know, remember I told you I never thought I was going to end up in working in space, or identify, you know, working in space as my passion and drive. But one thing that I've learned by working in space-related matters on a daily basis is to see our lives from the lens space, and I think that's it's a great privilege, and I wish more and more people would have that practice of looking at us as individuals and looking at our world through the lens of space. Because we really are small and insignificant at the large universal scale, and also helps us define what truly matters to us and to the generations that are coming after us, for which we have a huge responsibility. Do we really want to leave this world a better place when we leave? And if we want to, then what is our individual commitment to contribute to that?
How do we look at what we're doing from the lens of space? Do you have a methodology for that?
So I think on a daily basis, what I do is I constantly feel like I'm integrated in something that's bigger than myself. I think that, and I try to look at it. I mean, did I come up with a scheme? Maybe I should write a blog on you know, what are the 10 things to look at your own life and your own contribution of your life to this world, you know, from the lens of faith. But it really has to do with what I have, what is my commitment to myself, and to my life, to bring the best contribution I can to this world, and how does that contribution to myself and to the world play a role into a bigger picture, into a bigger driving force that's beyond, you know, governments on this planet and beyond what's going on just at the surface of the Earth.
Interesting. I don't know. That subject doesn't come up very much on the space show. So maybe it should. Maybe listeners will certainly want to comment on that. We're coming up toward the end of 90 minutes. We can certainly go over a little bit if we have more callers or more emails, especially given the technical glitches that we've had. Is new space? I'm sort of getting that for you, new space is in addition to, but not necessarily part of the government space effort. Am I hearing that right, or are you considering one supports the other, and it really is part of government space and government space policy? Or is new space, as you see it, really separate, but they can work together from time to time?
I think in an ideal world, right, they should work together. And they should work together in supporting each other and in acknowledging the value that each other brings. So in general, and that goes from, you know, the spirit in a team, it's not good to dismiss anybody's contribution. Everybody brings something. You just need to have that bandwidth of sitting down and understanding, you know, who contributes what and what is the best combination of that skill set in order to help move the needle that's in the best of everybody. So it's really how you start that conversation, right? And like in everything else, can you find that team spirit here and work driven by that team spirit. I hope that answers, you know, briefly your question.
It does. I have another question, and listeners, if you do want to call us, you need to do so pretty quickly. The phone number, once again, 1-866-687-7223. The same with your emails, drspace, drspace, at thespaceshow.com. And so James is in Atlanta. And James says, while we do cooperate in space with many different countries and individuals and businesses in many different countries, we also have clearly space adversaries. So space has a militaristic component to it. How does that fit in with all of your plans, or is that just an added fact of life that we have to contend with in the modern era?
I'm personally opposed to violence of any kind, and having lived in Romania to the 1989 revolution and to the fall of communism there, I hope you would understand why I'm saying what I'm saying. But the other lesson that I've learned from there, and the reason I'm mentioning that because I think it brings value to you know, maybe an answer to your question. I don't believe that revolutions are in general good, because they're disruptive, and disruptive things take a system out of equilibrium. And when a system is out of equilibrium, you really don't know when and how it's going to go back, and it impacts generations. So it is much better to find a smoother way of transitioning from one generation to another, from one way of thinking to another, and to pass on the baton. I think we've forgotten to pass on the baton from the older generation, or the generation that are ahead of us, to the young generation that are coming after. And I think it's really sad. We really need to find a way here in which we respect each other's value. We respect the wisdom of the generation ahead of us, and we respect the energy and the enthusiasm of the generations that are coming up. And we have broken that chain of communication. We're not passing the baton anymore. We're not being respectful in that chain of communication in many segments of society. And so that is actually one source, in my opinion, of an underlying conflict. Going back to my youth, if I would have had a choice, or more better choices of what I would study, I would study conflict resolution a lot. And the other comment that I have here is, how do we play together? Do we play based on the fear of not losing, or the desire of winning and creating, again, a prosperous future for all the other, for everybody? Because that really, again, sets the tone into how do we do things, how do we interact with each other, how do we perceive competition, and how do we turn competition into co-opetition, right? There's no adversary here. If you go back to that lens of faith, there's no adversary. It's us against us in the end. Because whatever we do and we fragment internally, it ends up fragmenting everybody. And so we all lose.
Okay. That's a good way to begin drawing down the program today. Have we missed something that you wanted to make points on or discuss with us? Have we forgotten something, left something out?
No, I think I'm good. I think I hopefully shared, you know, a couple of main points that I've been thinking about and that have been guided me to both my personal and my professional life, and I just hope that this would encourage or plant the seed for good thought and good practices and goodwill in the world. Thanks again for the opportunity.
you mentioned a blog. Do you have a blog? Do you have a newsletter with any one of your companies? Do you have a way to continue to communicate with interested people in your thoughts and ideas and work?
Yes, so yes, definitely. We actually have with G-Space, we have a newsletter, and we've been keeping up the pace for the past 3 months. And I've been thinking about starting a blog, but it goes back to with Gravity Free too, and explore some of these ideas. So I'm open to collaboration and help, and if anybody else out there is interested in you know, joining forces, please contact me. I'd love to do at least contributions for now. If I'm not really ready to commit to a regular blog just on my own, but I'm happy to contribute to other blogs efforts out there.
How do we find your newsletter?
Just send an email at info@zerogspace.com.
Okay. At zerogspace.com. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm sure we will talk to you again in the future, and I'm glad to have gotten to know you, and I'm looking forward to having refreshers on what you're talking about down the road, and maybe later in the year when we see how we're doing once we're on the other side of this virus and economic lockdown stuff. So I think it'll be real interesting to see how we're rebounding and if we're going off in some of the directions you've strongly advocated for on this show. Or if we're gravitating, hate to use that word again, but if we're if we're gravitating back to the same old, which in many ways I hope is not the case. But
sure, any time, would love to, and I wish everybody a gravity free regard, which is my favorite ending.
Okay.
So.
Gravity free regards to you too, and we look forward to talking to you again. Listeners, that is it for today, and again, archive listeners, you'll hear all these references to phone glitches and things. You're not going to notice them, so just get past that and ignore that. That's for the benefit of apologizing to the live audience. Tuesday, don't forget Bruce Cordell comes back. EMPs with Chaim Ben Arroyo on Hotel Mars, and then our Friday program and our Sunday program with Dave Mastin. So that should be very, very interesting, because he may be one that takes us back to the moon. Everybody have a great rest of the weekend. Do keep safe, and also, as always, keep looking up. So goodbye from Iwani, Dr. Kazumuda, and David, and the Space Show.